Okay, this is continuing with Dick McGee on 27 February 78. Now, could you just explain to me, I know that the Mills Cross versus Big Dish decision was made later, and how did that come about vis-a-vis the decision between the hole in the ground and the Big Dish and so forth?
Yes, I don't think there was any connection between those two decisions. The thing was that the decision to go for the steerable dish just had to be made at the and the hole in the ground idea was just cut off. And I went to Dover Heights straight after that decision. The decision for the Mills Cross didn't come up because Mills Cross was only getting going at Fleurs. It was followed immediately by the Shane Cross at low frequency, around 19.7 megs, and great success came from those two, so that it wasn't until, say, 58, 59 that the decision had to be made as to whether a large Mills Cross, say a mile in an arm's length, had to be made, and I think this was the time that Burney decided that if he wasn't going to come in on the large dish, then he should go elsewhere, which he did.
Right.
So
what did you then begin working on? You say you went now to Bolton's
right,
hole in the
ground.
Right,
I was now sent to Dover Heights where John Bolton had a station. And Gordon Stanley and Bruce Slee were his offsiders on the technical side. And Kevin Westfold, who at this stage had left the lab, used to come out one or two days a week and work on theoretical problems with us out there. And my first job at Dover Heights was the soldering up the chicken wire that was covering the hole in the ground out there, and in the meantime Gordon Stanley was developing this 400 meg receiver.
You made a comment about John Bolton, if you'd repeat that.
Oh well, I think everyone knows that if you're able to do these manual tasks, then with John you come good. I'll just throw in a story now then, if you like.
Sure.
John thought that, he told me that Ron Akers was no good. Ron Akers was here as a student, a summer student, and we sent him to Parkes.
This is now in the early 60s or something.
Yeah, when he was still at the university.
Right.
And John sent him downstairs to make some tea, and John said he couldn't even find the kettle. He'll be no good. Because Ron redeemed himself up there later and became one of John's...
So these were the criteria that are important.
Yeah, Ruby Payne Scott, who you probably heard a lot about, and was an outstanding physicist. John told me that she was no good because she was with him out of Dover Heights, and she opened a tin of paint and started painting immediately without mixing it. She didn't know anything. So this is... John has these... snap decisions that he makes, and he's a tremendous fellow to work for. If you're on his team, then he's virtually overprotective of you,
mm-hmm.
and anyone outside he doesn't like. Now,
so this dish was being upgraded for use at 400 megahertz, was it?
400 megahertz. Right. We started. We had to get the receiver going, of course, then. And Gordon Stanley had this front end where his idea was to have a cavity instead of the usual Dickey switching, to Dickey switch with detuning the cavity once every 50 cycles, at least at 50 cycle rate. And it was the devil's own job to keep this thing going.
This was, you told me, a plastic thing that
came
in and out.
He had a plastic disc that... used to rotate in and out of a slot in the cavity.
But nevertheless, it finally did work, so that you...
It worked of a sort, but we got on to more conventional stuff later. another idea of John's was that Gordon Stanley, and you might want to use this lot, but that Gordon Stanley was a very good ideas man, but he didn't have the... John would get Gordon thinking about a job, he'd get all the ideas, and then he'd say, right, now I'll get this built, I'll use Bruce Lee to get this built, I'll think up another idea and get Gordon thinking on that. But this is how we got the 400 going. You got Gordon thinking about some other job.
Now, did you say that you put your front end up at the front end, and that was something different?
We thought we were doing something different there, but you've pointed out to me that Greg Reber, in fact, had his front end right on the feed. We'd tried putting the front end at the bottom of our 40-foot pole. And we got into all sorts of matching difficulties, and to get out of that we made a little box and shoved it right up on top of the pole, on top of the dipole in fact, and we got good success with this.
Now the only disadvantage of doing this, I guess, is access. I mean, you've got to become a lineman to get up there.
It was a damn nuisance to bring the pole down. We used to set the pole by theodolite, and we had... a 2-degree beam, and we were able to move the beam by plus or minus 16 or 17 degrees. And of course, we were favourably placed for the Sagittarius A, mm-hmm. and this very large source came up, much more prominent than I think than anyone had seen it before.
Because you're at these higher frequencies. So.
Yeah, we were at a higher frequency, we were at 2 degrees. Resolution, which was something quite good in those days, and I was pretty ignorant of the whole story of radio astronomy, but it turned out that I just did a... What happened was that at this time John Bolton changed over to cloud physics, would you believe, and I was left on my own out there at Dover Heights, and I did the... I was very lucky. I was able to do the whole thing on my own. And it was the usual Esterline Angus chart recorders, and take it off and plot it, everything done by hand. Well, I produced this plot and just said, oh, well, this is the result of the survey. And great excitement was caused by the appearance of this enormous source poking out of the stuff. And Pawsey was in close touch with Walter Barter at this time, mm-hmm. and Jan Oort, and he sent them copies of the thing, and they wrote back immediately to say, look, we think that you've got onto the galactic nucleus. And I was more or less persuaded to send a note off to Nature to this effect.
And this is the 54 paper, McGee and Bolton.
Yeah, and I insisted that John came in on it, and...
Mm-hmm. And you call it probable observations of the galactic nucleus, so you were not...
Well, yeah.
Probably should really be observations of the probable galactic nucleus, right? You're pretty sure about the observations, I hope.
Right. I had possible or something, and Pawsey said, look, you're going to have to commit yourself. You've got to say probable.
I see. Was this sort of automatic that you went back after 24 hours and picked up the strip chart recording, or did you have to be out there manning it?
We could leave it going after we got to know it, of course. Yeah, it was. We used to travel out from the university out to Dover Heights, which is out on the coast, about 8 miles from the land, and we'd be out there from 8 o'clock till about 6 or so, things like that. It was an interesting sidelight out there that Pawsey lived out at Vaucluse, which is just near Dover Heights, and we'd be thinking of going home around the 5 o'clock mark, and Joe would turn up and he'd want to talk shop. And he'd want to use the equipment. He liked to twiddle knobs.
Right.
In fact, we used to have
we used to put in the, what we call the pausey knob, something for Joe to turn, keep him happy.
And you, but you wanted to make sure you saw which ones he was twiddling also, so you didn't, right. Didn't want to leave him to himself.
And quite often, he'd be out there at 5 to 6, and he'd say, oh, time for my tea, which is dinner in your your terminology, and off he'd go, and we'd have to find our way home.
Right.
30 miles away from that time. At that stage, I tried to make a measurement. In order to calibrate this 400 survey, I tried to make a measurement of the cold sky in my ignorance. And I used to get out there around about 3 a.m. trying to, with all sorts of line stretches and cold loads. And Joe Pawsey would always come along and help out with these. Mm-hmm. And we just tried to make these measurements. We tried to measure polarization, and a lot of the things that came later, we didn't have much success, but we were trying them out at that stage.
So you were trying to get the galactic background polarization.
Yeah.
Did you publish results?
We put a sentence in one of those papers about it.
In the McGee, Slade, and Scanlon.
Yeah, not very significant. Something that I suppose I oughtn't tell you, but at the time, Centaurus A was, we could get on the furthest extremity of the our swing. And I had this great drawing of Centaurus A, and John Bolton, you know, stretching out the 10 degrees or whatever it was.
Contour map of it.
The map that you see now.
Right.
I'd produced in 1953. But John said, look, you just can't have a radio source like this. You've got interference. You've got, so just slice off the main part of the source that you've got there. I've actually got the diagram somewhere of that.
But you acquiesced in this.
Pardon?
You didn't argue, well, let's do it again and see if it's interference or something like that.
Well, we tried it again. It was... the trouble was that I was on my own there, pretty ignorant. And you see, John had just come back after the whole thing was finished, just to look over the results, mm-hmm. so that it wasn't the sort of thing that had the opportunity of having another look. I'd done it several times, and I was happy that it was, that was what it was like, but it was just so foreign that you just couldn't have a thing like that.
Right. Well, is it fair to say that you were not astronomically oriented all that much at this stage, and that, you know, if you had been more into the astrophysics of radio sources, then this big radio source might have fascinated you more, or something like this, and you would have followed it up. Is that fair to say?
I'm just not a very bright fellow, that's all.
No, I didn't say that.
But that's so.
I mean, you were producing good results on the radio physics side.
Mm-hmm.
So what else did this survey show up? What were the important results from this?
We added a number of sources that, at that stage, you know, you only had, in the galaxy, you only had... say, out of 9 important sources, and we had 3 or 4 of those that were able to be added. And the fact that we had the resolution of the 2 degrees, around about that time, 2 degrees was being realised in the north by Henry Brown and Hazard, that got a bank.
Right.
Yeah. So we were able to tie in with their results.
And what were you making of these sources as to what they were? Was it...
We did some spectra. We tried to combine some spectra work, and we guessed. We stated, but I suppose we really guessed that some were thermal and some were non-thermal. And then Kevin Westfold and I tried to do some, tried to push in some theory, but that never saw the light of day. On just as well with the.
What kind of theory do you mean?
Oh, trying to develop a model for the galactic center source, for example.
And what sort of approach were you taking?
Well, it was... well, it was highly applied mathematical. I've just forgotten the full details of how what Kevin was about there, but he was trying to build up a series of ellipses or ellipsoids that can combine with say the disk of the galaxy, and then a number of ellipsoids that would build up the source. We're inclined to think that it was, you know, something big. Better resolution, of course, has shown that there's much, much more complicated.
So you were trying to build up the whole galactic center region, not just maybe 10 or 20 degrees worth, not just...
In much the way that the stellar people have done
with populations of stars. Yeah. I see.
Anyhow, that shut down in the lab.
Internal refereeing?
The usual symposium type things that were criticisms and so on. We decided that we'd better withdraw that. Yeah. And then at Dover Heights at that time, John was just finishing off the scene interferometer work, which I'll leave. That was being done by Bruce Slee.
Mm-hmm.
And so that with John having left Dover Heights and the 400 coming to a close, Gordon Stanley and a fellow called Bob Price from the MIT, Lincoln Labs, wanted to look for deuterium, and I guess you'll get the story from them, 327 where they redesigned the 400 megs into 327.
This was in response to the Russians' claim of a detection?
Yes, Joe Pawsey asked that be looked into, and the hope was that we might be able to pick up the 327.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the results, I think, were published in a letter to Nature.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
And so that was the last thing that whole...
So then Dover Heights was finished as a radio astronomy field station. And just about this time, Joe Pawsey had put out his idea of a multi-channel receiver for hydrogen mine. And he'd started John Murray working on it in the lab, and he asked me if I'd like to come in and do 2 or 3 years hardware work on the bench, which naturally I didn't have much choice anyway, and I was glad to do. And I worked on various aspects of things like low noise IFs and multipliers for the local oscillator. And in general, we had John Murray as the engineer and I was the physicist, but I was really the helper at that. And we had Mal Sinclair making filters. And a fellow called Jack Olson now died last year, helping out on the general wiring. And we moved from there, from the lab, up to a place called Murray Bank, which was a place where John Murray lived in West Pennant Hills near Sydney. It's quite close to this site here. And we set up the receiver there and built a 22-foot paraboloid to do H1 observations. Another one of Joe Pawsey's theory was that you can get good work out with a low resolution. He thought by not worrying about going for a big dish, you could get the job done cheaply, you could get results out with low resolution. Now, we struck all sorts of trouble in trying to make this hydrogen line receiver.
Let me just ask about the previous hydrogen line work that had been done on the Magellanic Clouds. And
yes.
What size dish was that? And where?
They had a 36-footer out at Potts Hill.
And what happened to that?
Well, it was still working out at Potts Hill. Karen Heinemann had been operating on this. Pawsey wasn't very happy with their experimental approach. You ought to keep that. You ought to censor that one out. But
anything I'll use, I will ask your permission.
This is what really happened, and he sent John Murray out to Potts Hill to see if he could rescue it, and John Murray couldn't get any work. John Murray's a very high-class engineer. He couldn't do any good with them out there, and Joe thought, right, let them continue on with their work. They've finally got the machine going, it's producing results. Let them continue their survey. They did the Clouds of Magellan, and they did the they were doing the Milky Way.
Right.
And attack the problem anew, so that the Mark One, what we call the Mark One multi-channel receiver, started right from Tours.
And the current Hyman was a single tunable?
It was a tunable local oscillator. Eventually they got three or four channels going, but it never really operated as a multi-channel, as a four-channel even, and they had all sorts of trouble about, they used to balance the back end with DC and money.
Now, how many channels did you have in this?
So we went 48 channels, a lot of our trouble was ignorance, I suppose. We were starting off, in those days, for example, we didn't have a satisfactory noise generator at 1420 megs. The K people, are we taking too long over this?
Not at all.
I think the K Electronics or somebody like that had produced one in the States, but we were too poor to buy one. So I set to work and made a copy.
I see.
K noise generator, would you believe? All sorts of things like this held us up.
But you also mentioned that Pawsey had this new idea for a multi-channel receiver. What was tricky about it? To me, it seems like there's nothing new in it other than doing many channels.
It's nothing new. It's just...
maybe multiplexing is a new aspect to it.
Well, it's just that everyone else was sweeping the local oscillator through a channel, the Dutch people and the Harvard people,
right.
And the people at Potts Hill. I suppose it is easy to say now that there was nothing in it, and that it was just 48 receivers and... But it took some making is to visualize in these times how hard it was to produce a multi-channel receiver in those days.
Well, it was a new concept, you're telling me, even though it was perhaps
It was new as far as radio astronomy was concerned, and just about this time Merle Tuve came out and decided to go ahead and make one in Washington with
For DTM.
Yeah. And in fact, they got theirs going before we did. And I think they put in quite a few... they improved on the design that we were thinking about and had quite a good receiver. Why they didn't exploit it more than they did, I don't know.
Of course, they didn't have the size of a group that you had here.
Well, we eventually got the thing working.
That took you how long altogether?
I guess it took us 4 years to get it going, to get it into a state where we actually produced results on the sky. Yeah.
And using this 22-foot?
22-foot dish, yeah.
Dish, right.
At one stage, Joe Pawsey decided that we'd failed, and he said, look, I'm going to close the project down, and we said, well, could you give us just a few days to wind it up? And we worked, I think, for 3 weeks we worked something like 80 to 90 hours a week. Once we produced a result on the sky, we were Whitehead boys again.
Right.
Things were looking very awkward there for a while.
Maybe that was why you said made that remark, was just give you the spur.
Yeah. So we did it. We did the sky survey of H1, then trying to get the whole sky rather than just the Milky Way, as Kerr and company have been working on.
And who is we now? Who is we? You say?
Oh, John Murray and myself. Yeah, John Murray and myself. And well, we produced a map of the local hydrogen, and. Several other papers came out giving details of all the low frequency local hydrogen and hydrogen around the Milky Way. Then, as a result of trying to analyse these 48 channels, I talked to Maston Beard, who was our expert on computers and so on, and said, couldn't we do something about putting this on tape? And he went away and thought about it and came up with a device to just take the code the thing off the recorder. We had let's think what sort of recorders we had. The old can't think of the name. I'm not Honeywell. What's another recorder? Speedamax. You know, the Speedamax recorders. Remember those?
I don't think I have seen those.
See, and they had we just had a disc on the back of it, the coated disc with the light shining through that.
I see. Onto,
and so we, Maston produced this machine that was able to get us on the paper tape. And in order to demonstrate the use of this, we did a quick survey of the Clouds of Magellan.
Now, what year are we talking about now?
We're up to 1960 now, so that's about as far as you want to go, is it?
Well, a little bit further, but I was just trying to get a benchmark
so,
there.
Yes, we completed the sky survey in 59 and 60, and then in 1960, we immediately went on and did the clouds. Heinemann came in on it, and Kerr came in on the writer. And we got this indication of the bridge of hydrogen between the two clouds. And a lot of that may have been due to the two. We had a 2-degree beam smudging across to give more evidence of the bridge than I think exists when we looked at it at 15-minute beam.
What was the resolution of the previous maps available?
Two degrees.
But the previous to the ones that you made in the mid-50s,
They were slightly better. They were 1.8 degrees or something like
and
that.
And they didn't show the bridge, so they had less sensitivity?
They hadn't got the sensitivity. On the Clouds of Magellan,
right.
They'd showed them separate, but... if you saw the original records that they were produced from, you'd wonder. In fact, they were extraordinarily good. I don't know how they extracted it from the records, and they agreed quite well with what we got.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that came out of this Murray Bank survey was the sharp edges on the western side of the small cloud and the eastern side of the large cloud, and then tape it off the other way. That was the first time that sort of phenomenon had been seen, and it's become, as you know, quite common now in galaxies. Yeah.
What did you make of it from an astronomical point of view?
Well, I don't suppose, I think we mentioned it. We didn't know what to make of it, I guess. Yeah.
Before you got the paper tape business going, did you have 48 channels on strip charts?
We had 48 channels on a chart recorder, and we used to subtract each one and write it down.
I sometimes wish that I were part of these early days of radio astronomy, but in this case, no, thank you.
Yeah, that was
And how did you reduce it, though? I mean, the tremendous amount of labor. Did you have...
Yeah, we had a girl, Jan Milton, who was a real hard worker.
Milton and McGee, yes.
Yeah, she used to take... She made up forms, and she'd write down 1 to 48. And that was, I mean, it was just stupid. The amount of effort that went into reducing that survey was really just too much.
Jeez.
And then they were integrated by Stirling's method or whoever's method as well.
To put the different drift scans together, you mean, or?
Yeah. Well. Yeah. I meant to integrate the. The area under the curve.
Oh, to get the the area
for the NH. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So it had just become a monster. We were able to obtain results 60 times faster than the Dutch people or anyone else, We couldn't handle it.
This is perhaps why nothing came out of the Carnegie, because they really couldn't handle it.
Yeah, well, that was it. You just have to take off, T-Max or something like that. But we worked over them. It wasn't until, 64 that we started getting the results out.
That's right.
It took us ages to get those out, yeah.
Let me ask you about a couple of these early results, though, that you published with Murray in Nature and Observatory and Australian Journal of Physics on the Taurus Orion region and the Pyxis Hydra region.
Right.
Why did you pick out these particular regions?
We just wanted to get. They were really just to test out the receiver. We didn't think the. Pyxis Hydra, whatever it was, there happened to be a nice little cloud there that was convenient to show up the method. That we,
I see.
So that was the reason for actually publishing that one. It was just something we could get on its own. What was the other?
Taurus Orion.
It was, of course, of interest because we'd hoped to see absorption there, but with our beam, we didn't pick it up.
Against Taurus A?
Yeah. But. We just published the cloud.
I see.
Yeah.
So that was that the end of that dish then, after the Magellanic Cloud?
Yeah, because at that stage we got to 61 and the dish was, the big dish at Parkes was fast coming to a head. I think people expected that it would take years to build, and in fact it got built 3 months under the 24 months that they anticipated. So we were, to our surprise, we were told to get the Mark I receiver ready for Parkes. We thought that this was a receiver that was designed to work on a very low resolution dish. And it had all sorts of troubles as far as, we were geared to work at two minute intervals for each.
I see.
And profile took 2 minutes. And
you integrated for 2 minutes and then dumped? Or?
Yeah, well, dumped is right. Then we had it. We had a telephone uniselector that went round selecting for one channel every 2 seconds.
I see, so the 48.
Yeah. Well, there was a couple of delays at the end. It came up to 2 minutes altogether. And with the large dish at Parkes, it just wasn't designed. But the thing was, the lab supplied a big dish. They didn't think of any budget for receivers. So you've got a highly successful Mark I receiver here, put it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's what we started working on there in 61.
So what other revisions did you have to make besides the integration time?
we wanted to improve its performance. We were coming in on a straight onto a crystal, a 1N21. And it was pretty difficult to get 1N21 E's or F's out here. We had very poor crystals, and occasionally we'd get a good one, and we'd just put that in our pocket and not say anything and produce it when... And the other thing in those days, we were working in separate groups in this lab, and each group had their research scientists, as you call them now, their experimental officer and their technical officer or technical assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked as separate entities. So when the H-line receiver went to Parkes, there were only one or two of us that could operate that machine, that knew how to operate it. And of course, we used to have to spend 3 and 4 weeks at a time at the Parkes, just acting as technicians virtually to keep the thing on the air. I mean, Frank Kerr would observe away for hour after hour. And you know Frank, of course, he's a compulsive observer. Quite often the baseline would get tilted because the matching had gone. And I'd say, look, Frank, go to the zenith, I'll wash up and rematch for you. And you'll get, no, you know, press on all night.
But the state of the receiver and the state of the art was such that you couldn't install it, and then it was good for 2 weeks. So you had to have
need a nursing.
A nurse there.
Yeah.
You
know. Yep. And I guess that was the way with all our receivers up there at that stage. Yeah. Just hanging back to the Sagittarius A, I mean, these days you just, you're onto Sagittarius A as soon as your receiver's going, because you just want to see, you just want to test your signal.
Mm-hmm.
Young fellas can't imagine how difficult it was for us to get onto it originally.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny thing.
To recognize there was a source there.
It's the same with, I mean, multi-channel works, old hat now, it's just silly to do it that way, but we thought it was great in those days.
Was the receiver the same as you used on the front end, as you used on the 22-foot dish, basically?
Yeah, the first one we used mm-hmm. at Parkes, yes.
And what sort of system temperature did it have?
Terrible system temperature of the order of 500K, I guess. Yeah. Very poor.
Well, compared to today, but that's not a fair comparison. Let's see. So what was the first... Apparently you spent a lot of your time helping others at Parkes in the first year or two.
Oh, well, I had my own project.
What were they?
Large Magellanic Cloud. And I think that was a very enjoyable project that... A whole lot of results came out because we started to isolate these individual blobs of gas in the large cloud. The resolution of 14 and a half minutes of arc meant that we were really, really seeing things in the mm-hmm. cloud. And I got onto this... the analysis of what I was observing, there seemed to be three separate velocity patterns in the large cloud, and I put forward this view that you had a classical spiral structure in the large cloud that comes out of the hydrogen. With a superimposed, there was the bar, coming out of the end of the bar was another spiral structure at a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
Spiral arms, small spiral arm. Hasn't been well received by the experts of the game, de Vaucouleurs or Kerr or any of them, but
you still hold to it today, 10 years later. You mentioned the point about receivers not really being planned for properly in Parkes. Would you say that the early years at Parkes suffered from that as a whole, or was it just in this line work that was true?
Well, there was so much coming out from the new dish, from the excellence of the dish itself, that the lack of good receivers we've been overshadowed, I guess. It was perhaps compensated in some way, but I don't think we'd want to do that
I don't think I'd want to do that sort of thing again, to have a tremendous dish of that nature. I say I don't want to do it again. We're doing it right now. The centre of the park's dish, the 17, is one of the best millimetre receivers in the world.
And how wide?
Reflector 17 metres.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember that the centre part of the dish there is steel.
Right.
Well, they've put an aluminium set of aluminium reflectors petals on that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was thought that it'd never be good enough. But Don Yabsley has got it down to working successfully at 3 millimeters.
Mm.
But the receiver we've got at 3 millimeters is terrible.
Mm.
So we have this old trouble of having good dishes and terrible receivers.
You think that's been a theme here at Radio Physics?
Yeah. We've had, I think, our 6 centimeter receiver is fairly good. The 11 centimeter was close to state of the art when Cooper first produced the quasi degenerate double channel receiver. That was very good, but we haven't none of the other receivers.
What about back in the 50s? Would you say that was true then also, or?
I think in the 50s. The receiver was as good as we could get out here, and of course America hadn't come in so much into radio astronomy.
Right.
You had to build your own, and I think from what was available, I think they were as good as could have been produced.
Why do you say that there was trouble getting stuff out here? It wasn't a matter of you didn't have good contacts in the various firms to.
No, it was mainly a budget difficulty, I think. But of course, there was the difficulty, say, of getting the Bell, the Western Electric tubes that were very good, had been developed for the telephone
mm-hmm.
repeaters, which had the very good noise factor. 6AK5s, are you familiar with tubes at all?
Not that familiar.
They were the wartime very good noise factor tubes. Now they were difficult to get, but then the Bell Company came out with these funny Optal, I think, pin tube. But the US Defense Department prevented them from being coming out of the States.
Nice.
In fact, people would smuggle them out in their pockets. And they were tremendous. Yeah.
And what did you actually use those in?
Yeah, we used them from time to time, yeah.
Nice.
John Bolton managed to sneak a few out after he'd been at Caltech.
Mm.
Yeah, but that's... Yes, we didn't have test equipment that was up to the mark, and we weren't able to get things like, well, circulators and isolators. All the wonderful equipment that's now available on sale in the States.
Yeah. Right. So it was just too expensive in the 50s.
I don't think they were really available, were they? Had to specify them and buy an enormous...
Right. So what you're saying, they were not off-the-shelf items,
yeah,
and therefore they got very expensive.
Like
yeah.
I mean, we had to make our own line stretchers, and line stretchers have gone out of fashion altogether now.
Yeah,
We were actually designing them and making them here, and even the impedance measuring devices we just built here in the lab.
Let me ask you a general question. During this period of the 50s and to early 60s,